The presenting partner of this episode of No Filter is HubSpot.
From Mamma Mia, I'm Mia Friedman, and you're listening to No Filter, a weekly interview podcast with people who tell their stories very candidly and aren't afraid to be all kinds of vulnerable. Lane Beachley has done a lot in her life. She's held world records, won world titles, and is regarded as the most successful female surfer in the history of her industry. She's suffered setbacks, career-threatening injuries, and she's conquered 50-foot waves. But those things I just told you about, they're probably the least interesting things about Lane's story.
I've considered this period to be like a triple E reset.
On this episode of No Filter, I sit down with Lane to discuss everything from her marriage to In Excess guitarist and sax player Kirk Pengilly.
So he stayed the night, but I made him sleep in his undies and put a pillow between us. And then I got up at 6 a.m. and went for a surf and left him alone in my bed.
To losing her mum and then finding out she was adopted.
It was a pretty significantly impactful or devastating, distressing time.
To getting liposuction at 24.
I wanted to have the perfect surfer's body, but I didn't.
To the mistakes she made while on world tours.
And so I was such a bitch at times, but that's what I believed I had to do to win.
I came away from this conversation with Lane just blown away by her life, her spirit and her self-awareness, her ability to reflect on all the shitty things that have happened to her, along with the great ones, of course, but to learn from all of it. She's done so much, and because she has so much time on her hands, she's also decided to launch an online course to help people find their internal GPS. Here is my very candid conversation with Lane Beachley.
I always check. You're a pretty open book.
Yes.
You know how all this works.
I do.
You're an AO, which means that you have an Order of Australia.
Officer of the Order of Australia, yeah.
Officer of the Order of Australia. And you're widely regarded as the most successful female surfer in history, having secured 7 world surfing titles, 6 of which were won consecutively 1998 to 2003. Mm-hmm. A feat achieved by no other surfer, male or female.
Correct.
I've always wanted to ask, on game days, on competition days for surfers, what's the plan? Can you take me through from the moment you wake up or even from the night before? How do you prepare both physically and mentally? And don't leave any detail out, like what do you eat for breakfast, all of that stuff.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's challenging because every day is different. And there's the benefit of being a professional surfer or just a surfer in general. I feel like we've got adaptability and the willingness to adapt to change ingrained in our DNA because no 2 days are the same. Perfect for a Gemini like me. And so when I look at the schedule, that will determine my preparedness. So say, for example, my heat is in the middle of the day. The day before, I will make sure I surf in or as close to the contest area as possible at that same time to get a familiar read on what the conditions are going to be like or what they're going to be doing and this particular tide and swell direction and swell height and wind direction, and just to get a good read on what the conditions are going to present to me so I can prepare myself for those changes. Then ideally I'd love to have a protein-rich dinner. There used to be this mentality that we had to carb up before going into competition, but that doesn't seem to be the case anymore because carbohydrates left unburned just turn into sugars. So I used to make sure that I had a protein-rich diet. As I got older and my preparation and training became more tactile, I would allow myself to have a glass of wine or two a night before competition. It didn't negatively impact me and it made me feel a little bit more relaxed. You know, I was able to sleep well.
You didn't feel foggy the next day.
I became a bit of a seasoned pro. And actually, during the early years of my career, I was quite piss fit. So,
what about sex? Some male athletes talk about not having sex the night before they have to compete.
I'd like to have sex the day I compete, actually.
Wake up with the morning glory.
Absolutely. And my husband, boyfriend or whoever can just sleep and I'm out there. I'm off. I'm like raring to go. Yeah, so I would tend to stretch and meditate before going to bed just to calm my central nervous system, to activate my parasympathetic nervous system, to put myself into a rest and digest and pause and play mentality. Otherwise, I can go to bed rehearsing the day and that just winds me up and then I don't get a restful sleep. Then in the morning, based on when the contest starts, so for example, if the contest starts at 8 a.m., I'll make sure I'm up by 6 to go and have a surf before the contest starts so I can surf in the contest area, iron out all the kinks and the bugs that I may have woken up with. Most often I had a pretty shit surf in the morning, and that was okay. I saw that as an opportunity just to rinse myself of all the possibility of failure. And then I would go home and have a really protein-filled breakfast as well. So it was either protein smoothie or it was scrambled eggs, depending on what country I'm in as well. That would dictate my food choices. So, for example, when we're in France, it's very easy just to go out and get a croissant and coffee. Now, I don't drink coffee, so my competition would go out and get a croissant and coffee, and I always stayed in houses so I could cook for myself. So I made scrambled eggs with goat's cheese and basil and tomato and maybe scramble a bit of pesto through it, and then I'd sit that on some corn cakes or rice thins because I'm intolerant to yeast, so I couldn't enjoy the baguettes and the breads and the cheeses that everyone enjoys over there. So I was the only one that lost weight in Europe while everyone else expanded.
No croissants for you.
No croissants. And then I'd have a green tea. I've always traveled and always taken magnesium powder just to help with the relaxation and the recovery. So I'd start my day always with a glass of water with magnesium powder. Then I'd go surf. Then I'd come back and have a nutritious breakfast and fuel. Also, having protein in the morning prevented the sugar crashes later in the day and gave me a sustained release of energy. Then I'd go down to the contest site about 2.5 hours before my heat, and I would just sit and watch the contest and create a game plan based on what was going on in the competition.
Would you listen to music?
Yes. So some days I'd listen to music, some days I wouldn't. In the early years, I was so easily distracted. I was worried about what everyone was doing, what everyone was saying, what they could potentially be saying about me, listening to the commentary, listening to the music. My peripheral vision was so broad that it actually prevented me from being able to narrow my focus. And one of the ways to narrow my focus was to put on headphones and zone out. So I started to rely on music. And then as I became more competent, I actually learned to find my on-off switch. So I could be like that. And then the minute I needed to turn on, I was able to zone in and narrow my focus and get the job done. And then, of course, my mood, because I had to ask myself each day, what state do I need to be in to get the best out of myself today? That starts with what state am I in now? There was times if I was really tired, I'd listen to music that would amp me up. So I'd listen to, you know, Linkin Park or Offspring or something that really jazzed me. And if I was too kind of frantic or too manic, I knew I needed to calm down, so I'd listen to Frank Sinatra or some soothing style of music to calm me down. So, yeah.
What was the worst part of that process? Was it the lead up, like the part that you dreaded the most?
I didn't dread any of it, quite honestly.
There wasn't a hard part where you just were like, I just want it to be over, or the part just before you get in the water, before the adrenaline kicked in?
No, I embraced the adrenaline. I embraced the nervousness. I embraced the challenge. And that's why I competed for 19 years. There's very few athletes that can stay on tour and put their bodies and their minds and their souls through that kind of torment day after day after day. The part that I didn't enjoy the most was when we would go on hold and the uncertainty of when we were going to compete again. And I just had to learn to embrace that as well, because I'd go down to a contest site, you know, I was all revved up, ready to go. My heat was going to start at 11 a.m. and I'd get to the contest site at 9. And because the conditions would change and we would go on hold, I would sit at the contest until sometimes 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Ooh, yeah.
And not compete all day and just have to sit there and wait. And we'd go on hold every hour after hour after hour. And you just had to keep yourself sane during those periods. That was one of the challenging times. But then in France, I loved the fact, and I'm sensing a theme here, that I loved competing in France, but the access to the rest of Europe made it so much more fun and enjoyable, and we're able to break it up. So I competed in the heat in Hossegor. The contest got blown out at 10 a.m. We're like, let's go to Spain. So we jumped in the car and drove to San Sebastian. And
oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, drank sangria and ate tapas and went shopping and drove home later that night and then woke up and did it all again the next day. So
when you say we with the other competitors, I wanted to know what your relationship was like over the 19 years with the other girls on tour.
Well, it went from being very supportive to incredibly tenuous to then coming back to mending some of the relationships that I had burnt over time. And
what made it tenuous?
I'm going to take full accountability and responsibility for this. And this is some of the stuff that I share really openly and honestly in my course, in Own Your Truth, because I'm not proud of the way in which I won. fortunately, most people don't remember how you won. They just remember that you did. But my peers will never forget that. And there's some peers that have never forgiven me for the way I behaved. And that's not solely because of the way I behaved, but it's also a reflection of how they just choose to hang on to that stuff. And that's a
whole. But what did you do?
I was really fierce. I was really fiercely driven, fiercely focused. I saw people as in the way, not on the way. I was quite brash. I was unforgiving. Occasionally I was quite hurtful. And I said things with the intention to be funny, but it was actually quite insulting. And I behaved in a way that rejected them, and also behaving in a way that gave them reason to reject me. So I ostracized myself. I put myself on my own pedestal. I said, well, you know what, if you're not going to measure up to my expectations, then fuck off. I can't be bothered spending any more time with you. Whenever I toured with the girls, I always brought someone with me, so that gave me an excuse not to have to spend too much time with them.
Do the other girls mostly travel alone?
They all hung out with each other and traveled together, because as women surfing in the 90s and 2000s, we weren't supported financially as significantly as the men were, and we had to really band together to afford to do the tour. I mean, 50% of the tour couldn't afford to do it anyway, and so they really had to, you know, watch their pennies and support each other. So they became a band, they became a tribe, and I felt like this little ostracized member of a tour that never truly belonged to the tribe.
How did you stop being a bit of a dickhead, as you would sort of describe it, and become closer to them?
Well, there was always a few girls on tour that I referred to as my accountability partners. They were my honesty barometers. They called me out on it. And they were the ones that I still have strong relationships with today. People like Pauline Mensah, Rochelle Ballard, you know, those two come to mind first, because they were the ones I spent the most amount of time with and they called me on it the most. The way I stopped was I committed to changing my behaviours by shining a light on what wasn't working. And there was a lot of things not working.
Well, you were winning everything, so that was
working. I was winning everything, yeah. So you could look at the outcome and go, well, that was easy. She smashed it. But no one sees the cost. No one sees what I was going through. No one clearly sees the impact it was having on my emotional, mental, and physical health. It was constantly compromised and sabotaged. I mean, my relationships with my peers was strained. My relationships with my loved ones was strained. My relationship with myself was built on a foundation of fear. Like, I just had to win at all costs. I was tagged as having the compassion of a tiger shark, and I just had to go out there and win. So if you were in my way, I'd bite you and let you bleed out and say, sucked in, fuckers. Like, I'm out of here, you know. And so I was such a bitch at times, but that's what I believed I had to do to win. Then I shined a light on it and go, well, this is unsustainable. My body's breaking down. I have really strained relationships with my peers. I'm going through a really tormenting time where I'm not happy and I'm not healthy. So something's got to change, and that change starts with me. And so I just took responsibility for it. And then I reached out to a variety of different practitioners and support network to help me pull my head in and do things a little differently.
Where were you at in your romantic life then?
I had just broken up with Ken Bradshaw, who I'd been with for 5 years. I won 5 world titles alongside Ken. And then I'd started dating Kirk Pengilly.
How did you and Kirk meet?
We were set up on a blind date by John Stevens. And it was an INXS show that they were doing. And John invited me along to the show and said, you have to meet Kirk. I came home from Europe having broken up with Ken, and I went to John's house to get the tickets. And I said, oh, by the way, Ken and I have broken up. And he's like, fantastic. Okay, this is going to be amazing. You and Kirk are made for each other. He laughs. He has fun. He knows what it takes to be the best in the world. You guys are going to hit it off and going to be the perfect match. Kirk and I both kind of reflect on that period and go, what did he see that we didn't? Because there was no chemistry. There was no connection. There was no interest in each other. He hated the sun. Passionately disliked the beach, and I spent my whole life at it. And quite honestly, when I was standing at the front of the stage watching Kirk, who I'd been a fan of since I was 14 years of age, so it felt kind of awkward, I was standing there looking at the stage going, John, you're hot, Kirk, you're not. Can I go? I was so shallow. However, I made an obligation to John that I would take Kirk on a date. So out of obligation, I took Kirk on a date. I took him 10-pin bowling at DYRSL because I'm such a classy broad. And then I took him to a restaurant in DY, and we sat down, and halfway through dinner, he and I are both yawning in each other's face. We've got no interest in being there. We're both sitting there going, damn you, John, it's all your fault. And then I go to the bathroom thinking, if there's a window to climb out of that's big enough, I'm going home. And then Kirk's sitting there while I'm in the bathroom thinking, if I just put money on the table and do a runner, do you think she'll care? The owner of the restaurant must have recognized things weren't going well because he sat down when I came out of the bathroom. He was sitting there with Kirk, and there was a fresh bottle of limoncello that his nonna had made, and we polished that off. And 10 years later, or on the 10th of the 10th of the 10th, we toasted our marriage with limoncello.
Did you go home together that night?
He came back to my house that night.
For a little boom boom.
Well, no, he stayed the night. I actually put on Monsters, Inc. I was into really...
This date gets better and better, you saucy minx, you.
Oh, my goodness, yes. I know really how to turn it on and seduce somebody. But I put on Monsters, Inc. because I was just totally into these animated kids films at the time. It was providing my whole life with a healthy perspective and balance, going from fierceness to fun. And we watched Monsters, Inc. And then halfway through the film, like, we really just need to go outside and kiss and see if this is going to work. And basically I was saying to myself, you know, if he's a good kisser, he can stay. If he's not a good kisser, he's going home once he's sobered up enough to drive. And he was good. So he stayed the night, but I made him sleep in his undies and put a pillow between us. And then I got up at 6 a.m. and went for a surf and left him alone in my bed. And he woke up alone going, oh, so this is what I'm in for. He'd already decided that he was going to stick around, which was really great.
Was there a moment where you thought, actually, or was it the kiss?
No, 4 days later, actually, it was the moment. We separated that day. He drove me. Well, we didn't separate. We split, you know, we went out separate.
Sounds dramatic.
I know it does, doesn't it? But he dropped me at my brother's wedding and then drove off to perform at Homebush that night. And then the next day we went on another date. We went to the movies at Fox Studios with Gold Class and watched Austin Powers. And then I stayed the night at his place. And that's when we consummated the relationship. And then the next 2 days we spent our lives kind of in separate worlds because he lived at Potts Point and I lived at North Curl. You know, during those couple of days I was starting to think I kind of miss him. Like I really want to see him. And I was packing my bag to go to Fiji and then off to Hawaii. And my PA, who's still one of my best friends, said to me, what do you think about Kirk? Do you want to see him again? I said, yeah, I really miss him. Like, I really want to see him again. So he came over that night and had dinner with me and my neighbours and he got to meet the family, which is just the neighbours, not my dad or anything. And then he went off on tour for 2 months. I went off on tour for 2 months and then we came back and kicked off where we left off.
You did have a lot in common when you think about your lifestyles and the place you were at in your careers, right, at around 2002?
Yes. As John suggested, we knew what it took to be the best in the world at something. I mean, INXS were the biggest band in the world. So they understood the work ethic and the time and the trust that's required for when you spend so much time apart. And I must admit, in the first 5 years of our relationship, we spent way more time apart than we did together. So just, you know, working through those things, the communication, the mutual admiration and respect we had for each other, and that's just developed over time. So, you know, most people look for their significant other that's a direct reflection of who they are, whereas we had the benefit of being polar opposites. And now as we've spent more and more time together, we're growing closer and closer and closer together. We started in the chasm and now we're closing it up. And now COVID has just presented us with such a valuable opportunity to strengthen our bond and strengthen our love for each other. And I wouldn't be where I am today without his support and unconditional love.
It's been almost 20 years, right?
It's been 18 years together and we're celebrating our 10th wedding anniversary this year.
The decision to get married, was that a major one for you both or was it just more it was a done deal?
It was pretty easy actually. I mean, I had always suggested, you know, I don't care if I get married or not. And he'd been married before to Denny Hines and he'd had a couple of unsuccessful engagements and he's got his beautiful daughter, April. So he's pretty settled in himself and his life. And all of a sudden, the Chinese horoscope of 10-10-10 appeared, and it was in 2008. We saw the significance of these numbers and decided that we'll get married in 2010. But first, he had to propose to me, so we got engaged in 2008.
How old was April when you met Kirk?
April was still in high school at Winona, so she must have been about 15.
How was it being a stepmom?
I've never really titled myself as a stepmother to April. I'm more of a girlfriend. You know, I enjoy just being her friend. And she lives with her mother and she adores her mother and she has such a great relationship with both Kirk and her mother, Karen. So I never positioned myself as someone that was going to step in and fulfill a role that I didn't feel entitled to fulfill. So I'm happy just to sit on the outskirts and add anything that I can whenever she needs it.
And tell me if it's too personal, because I know for some women it is, but were children something you and Kirk discussed?
No, I was adamant from the first day that we met that I didn't want children, and I've never wanted children. And I actually made him have a vasectomy in the first 6 months of our relationship. So I was 100% clear on that. And he was 100% okay with that because he already had one. And that's just something that I've always been clear about. And it took me some time to get a really clear read on why I didn't want to have children. And that's a really long story, but I'll give you the short version. Is I came to the awareness that I value and love my life so much that I'm not willing to compromise it. And it's all anchored in, you know, the foundation of selfishness, but it presents me with the opportunity to share my lessons and knowledge with a broad demographic and with the masses. And I know having children doesn't prevent you from doing that. But having had my own charity for 15 years, I found all the girls that we supported through Aim for the Stars as kind of like surrogate children. Yeah, I just decided that that's the life that I want to live.
Because there's lots of different ways to mother, isn't there?
Oh, sure. Yeah, and there's lots of different ways to share your love and compassion and nurturing for others, and it just doesn't have to be with your own children.
You're listening to No Filter with me, Mia Friedman, talking to Lane Beachley. When all your marketing team does is put out fires, they burn out fast. Sifting through leads, creating content for infinite channels, endlessly searching for disparate performance KPIs, it all takes a toll. But with HubSpot, you can stop team burnout in its tracks. Plus, your team can achieve their best results without breaking a sweat. With Breeze, HubSpot's collection of AI tools, you can pinpoint the best leads possible, capture prospects' attention with click-worthy content, and access all your company's data in one place. No sifting through tabs necessary. It's all waiting for your team in HubSpot. Keep your marketers cool and make your campaign results hotter than ever. Visit hubspot.com/marketers to learn more.
Your festive gifts are sorted with new holiday sets available at Maya. Unwrap Joliet's skin, hand and body gift sets containing a selection of favourites to delight this festive season. And discover festive luxury with Maya exclusive Alive body holiday sets, perfect for effortless gifting. Or indulge in the ultimate self-care experience with Maya's deluxe beauty box, filled with 19 carefully curated favourites, valued at over $275 and retailing for just $89. Shop beauty and gifting in-store and online at maya.com.au.
Lane, your mum died when you were just six.
One of them.
Yeah. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So fortunately, as a six-year-old, I didn't have the concept of forever, but when she did pass away, it was a pretty significantly impactful or devastating, distressing time. I remember Dad coming home from the hospital saying, "Your mum's gone, she's never coming back." And I remember putting my eyes in my pillow and bawling my eyes out, and I mean my face in my pillow, bawling my eyes out, and just going, "Wow, that just sucks. I don't know what it means for me, and I don't know what it means for the rest of my life, but I know what it means right now, and it hurts."
Had she been sick?
No, she hadn't been sick. She went into hospital for cosmetic surgery. And due to undetected high blood pressure, she died of a brain hemorrhage on the operating table.
Oh, my God. What sort of surgery was she having?
She was basically having a tummy tuck because she had an emergency C-section when she had my brother, and those scars, so they botched up the surgery or the stitching after the surgery. And she was a very beautiful, petite, quite vain woman, and the scars started to encroach upon her bikini line, so she went in to get that corrected, and it cost her life.
Do you remember how she talked to you before she went in? Was it kind of like, "I'll see you soon, be good for Dad"?
I've blocked it all out, and especially at that age, you know. I don't really have very strong memories of Valerie.
You call her Valerie because 2 years later, what did you find out?
Oh, that I was adopted, so she wasn't my mum after all, but of course she was my mum, you know. It's amazing how you say these things to yourself. But my dad, even though he's not my biological father, has always been my rock and my, you know, my one constant, and he's the one that helped me build the resilience that I've established in my life. So my dad told me I was adopted when I was 8, which upon reflection and in hindsight, it was way too late. You know, by the time you're 8, your brain waves have shifted to a point where you now have the capacity to judge, criticize, analyze, and create your own thoughts on what things are like, as opposed to, you know, in the first 5 or 6 years, you're still a sponge, you're absorbing, you're narcissistic. When he told me that, that was the catalyst for me to go, oh, what, wait, I've been rejected and abandoned by my own mother? Oh, crap, okay, I don't like that. I don't like how it makes me feel. So I need to become a world champion for me to be deserving of love of anybody. And so that's when I set my sights on becoming a world champion in anything. And it wasn't until I was 14 that I decided that surfing was going to be that platform.
Do you know the circumstances around your adoption?
So my mother told me that I was conceived through date rape. She was 16 or 17 years of age. She was 17 when she gave birth to me. She knew my father's first name but doesn't know his second name or can't recollect his second name. So when SBS, Who Do You Think You Are, approached me to do that program, I wasn't able to do it because they can't find evidence of him. However, everything that mum stated kind of checked out throughout their research. So she was an aspiring model. She went out with this guy who owned a modeling agency. He invited her to dinner, then invited her home, and that's when she was taken advantage of. She fell pregnant, and then her parents, which were devout Catholics, told her that she wasn't allowed to keep me. She was too young, not equipped, not emotionally mature enough to take on the responsibility of a child, and was forced to give me up for adoption. So I was 6 weeks premature. I was in an absolute rush to get the hell out of an environment that I knew I wasn't really welcome in. Anyway, I ended up in a humidity crib for 6 weeks, and she was never allowed to hold me. So I also attribute that lack of nurturing, love, bonding, connection with my ferocity, with my fierce competitive nature and that desire to push people away, that fear of affection, that is definitely attributed to that part of my life.
Why at age 8 do you think your dad decided it was the time to tell you?
Because the kids down the street were asking, why do you look so different to your parents? Why do you look so different to your brother? You don't even look anything like your family. You know how kids are.
Yeah.
Your dad's 6'2", your brother's 6'. They're all pasty white skin. They got brown hair. My brother's got brown eyes and brown hair, and I was 3'0" with dark olive skin and bright blue eyes and blonde hair. It's like, which stork dropped you at the front door? So to put a bit of perspective around that, Dad thought it was the ideal time to sit me down and tell me the truth before it got found out from anybody else.
And did you straight away want to find your birth mother?
No, not really.
Even though you'd lost your mother and you had this big hole where a mother should have been in your life.
Yeah, I actually didn't want to start looking for my birth mother until I was about 23. Don't know why that was the age, but it just got to a point where I felt really lonely and I was desperately seeking the nurturing of my mother and the arms of my mother to kind of feel safe in. And I think it was because I saw a lot of my competitors were spending a lot of time with their mums on tour, or when they were off tour, they were always talking about the conversations they had with their mothers. And I was like, I really miss that. My dad's not the mothering type. He's the tough love type. So I really was missing that. And he had gone on and found a new partner when I was about 14. He met this beautiful woman called Christina and married her when I was around about 24. And so I think it was around that period I thought, well, he's moved on. He's found a new woman. I've got a baby sister. So he's got a whole new family. And I feel like I don't belong anywhere again. So now I need to find my original family to see where I come from.
Was it easy to find her?
No, it wasn't. I found a birth certificate that suggested that I was born to a Scottish woman named Margaret Campbell Gardner. And she lived in Surrey Hills at the time. So I was really grateful. I was like, oh, dodged a bullet there. There's no way I would have grown up a surfer as I was living in Surrey Hills. And that satiated my curiosity for a period of time. Just knowing the circumstances of my birth, it kind of just felt like it put things into perspective for me, where I felt comfortable with that and went, okay, so she was young and good idea that she gave me up, and I'm grateful that she did. And I landed in a beautiful home with a really loving family. Yes, I lost my mother and now I feel like I don't belong anywhere, like I feel stateless. But yeah, that just centered me for long enough. And then 3 years later, she got on the phone and found me. And that started a sequence of events that was a real tumultuous journey.
Do you remember the day you met? I mean, of course you do.
I do, yes. It was like looking in the mirror in 17 years. There was no question she was my mother. It was 2 months before I won my second world title. And, of course, all my close friends were worried that she was being a gold digger or a fame digger, or, you know, she's out to take advantage of you. And I thought, I'm just going to suck it up and see. I really want to meet this woman. She sounds legit and she's saying all the right things. So, yeah, I went and saw her. We met at San Francisco Airport because she was living in America. When I saw her and we just had a chat, it was like a couple of girlfriends catching up, and it was a really easy conversation. And then she just wanted more and more and more and more of me. And in my ferocious, fearful of rejection ways, I just kept her at arm's length. Like, I'm in control. You just stay back, stay back, stay back, stay back, stay there, stay there, stay there, go away. That's what I did to her. And so then I recognized the error in my ways and I opened up my arms to her and I went, I'm so sorry. I wasn't trying to prove you wrong. I was trying to prove myself right. I'm sorry that I treated you this way. That gave her license to then reject me again. And so we just had this ebb and flow of come here, go away, come here, go away, which, yeah, made it a really challenging relationship. And then a couple of years ago she rang me and said, and we hadn't spoken in about 6 months. You know, we really spoke on birthdays and Christmas. We really had this. And I'd gone to America and spent time with her and, you know, met her family and met my other half-sister, Melissa, and yeah, spent some quality time there. But still, there was always this dance going on with the two of us. And even when I wrote my book, Beneath the Waves, that gave me some real clarity around the way I was behaving and what was happening and how I need to do things differently. And so that's when I opened up and that's when I was rejected again. But a couple of years later, I got this phone call from her saying, they've given me 3 weeks to live. Can you come and see me before I go? It's like, oh, God, here we go again. There goes another one. So I jumped on the plane, flew to Spokane, and she was so fragile, so frail. She'd been dying from cancer for months and it was undetected or they'd misdiagnosed it and it ended up being ovarian cancer. But I was very fortunate that I had this, I don't know if you've ever had to sit bedside or host a vigil for someone that's dying, but they go through this time in their throughout this death period where they get that spark of life right before they go. And I had that with her, with my sister Mel, no one else in the room. And I thought, wow, that's fun. You know, that's the way I remember Mum. And then she fell asleep, never woke up again.
Do you have therapy? Oh, Lane.
Yes, the ocean.
I'm sorry. You speak okay. about it in such a direct way. I can tell it's a story you've told a lot of times and it must take you by surprise sometimes, the grief.
Yeah, it does.
You must miss her.
I do. I miss all of them. All three of them.
Who's the third?
So Christina died when I was 30 from breast cancer.
Oh, Lane, I didn't realise that. So you lost your stepmother, your biological mother and your adopted mother.
Yeah.
How do you process that?
You don't. Well, you do. I mean, you process it. We all process it in any way we can. And I'm processing it all the time. As you can tell, like you say, the grief takes me by surprise. So, have a glass of water. Hang on. Yeah, one of the ways I process my grief or my anger or my sadness or my fears is I dive in the water. I go surfing or just immersing myself in nature is really grounding and centering and calming. And that's what I get from going in the water. It's like going back into the womb, quite honestly. It's like, oh, I feel so held, so nurtured.
Does it give you a complex relationship with your own body? Because your own body is the tool of your success was during your sporting career, and yet it failed your three mothers, certainly two of them dying from cancer. What sort of relationship do you have with your body?
As an athlete, I saw my body just as a tool to get what I wanted. And whenever it broke down, I just saw that as a sign of weakness and a sign of like it's a challenge I had to overcome. And so I never really addressed my failings. And it wasn't until my body completely broke down. I mean, it's broken down several times from chronic fatigue syndrome twice to really severe injuries. And it was this neck injury that I had that was severing 80% of my spinal cord that really made me address the strained relationship that I had with my body. Like I was just so hard on myself. I lacked empathy for myself. You know, I had that wave land on my neck. My left arm went numb. I had atrophy and pain for 5 years. And I was like, just get on with it. Just block it out. Just get on with it. And now I'm in this constant pain management where I'm just allowing my body to be what it is and honoring it, feeding it with proper nutrition, giving it rest, doing some meditation, doing something I love every day, immersing myself in nature, seeing my NET specialist, acupuncture, massage, yoga. I nurture and nourish my body today because I know how fragile it can be. So I have a much more compassionate and empathetic relationship with my body and myself than I once did. I am enough. You know, I've learned that now. It took me 6 consecutive world titles and an immense amount of pain, suffering and struggle to realize that I am enough. And I had the ability and the opportunity to choose that before I flogged myself to death, but I didn't choose to see it.
I'm always so interested to talk to female athletes about body image because your bodies are your tools and yet you still live in the same world that every other woman lives in, yeah. Which tells us we have to look a certain way.
Yeah. And we never look good enough, no matter what.
Female surfers, what's the kind of body image vibe in the surfing world?
Well, back in the 80s, actually, you know what? Women surfing in general, I feel, has always had a stigma attached to it that you're meant to look a particular way in a bikini. And if you don't look that way, then you're never going to fit in. There's an amazing movie coming out called Girls Can't Surf. And it's like a documentary around what women surfing endured and then became and evolved to from the late 70s, 80s and 90s into the 2000s. And it's a fascinating tale about how we were treated, how we treated ourselves, how we treated each other, and how the industry expected certain things of us, and how if we didn't conform to that, how we were immediately rejected. And from my own perspective, I wanted to have the perfect surfer's body, but I didn't. I'm short. I've got a little bit wider hips. I carry a little bit of weight in different areas. And yet I wanted it to be what it wasn't. So I went and got cosmetic surgery myself. I went and had liposuction, which if I knew what the long-term implications were associated with the liposuction, there's no way I would have gone through that because my body was still changing and growing in my 20s.
What are they? What happens?
Well, because with liposuction, you take all your lymph nodes out, and so the fat deposits, they have to find other places to sit. So when your body would be naturally processing them, they don't have that system to be drained anymore. It just finds another place to to sit.
Where did you get the lipo?
On my inside of my inner thighs, because I wanted that keyhole, what would they call it, a keyhole look? I wanted
thigh that. Gap, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd never had that, and I still don't. I'm totally okay with that. But when I was 24, I wanted to look like the beautiful girls. And then there was a lot of eating disorders. There was a lot of boob jobs. I mean, the girls just did things to please or in the event that they might be able to attract a sponsor that sees value in them. So I went through that process. I never had an eating disorder. I just had a body image disorder. You know, I never really embraced my body for what it was. And I hated my body when I was in my 20s because I was a toothpick kid. I had no issues with weight or whatever I ate when I was in my teenage years. And then I went on the pill and all of a sudden, oh, I just became a little fat frump as far as I was concerned, and I hated my body. And that's a really strong word to use, and I don't like using it very often, but I passionately disliked myself, and I would beat myself up, and then I'd go on a diet, and then I'd do all the right things, and then I'd reward myself with a piece of apple pie. You know, so I'd do the right things, then sabotage, do the right things, then sabotage, and thought that I'd done the right things for long enough that now I've earned myself the opportunity to go and do something as extreme as liposuction. And now I feel like my body's in the best shape it's ever been. And that's probably because I've embraced who I am and I'm more confident inside my own skin. And I'm fitter and stronger and healthier because I'm not pushing myself and expecting so much of myself as I once did. So all the valuable life lessons that you generate in hindsight are so rich. If you had to go back and give your 20-year-old self some advice, where the fuck do you start?
Where do you start? Well, you say your body's beautiful, stop obsessing. Like,
yes.
You don't have to deal with gravity yet.
No, and it will change, and it's going to continue to change.
It does continue to change. I remember seeing an ad, I think, for a surfwear company starring a female surfer, I can't remember who it was, a few years ago, and the camera was just really like up her bum, and it was showing her paddling out, and her cozy was pulled up in her bum, and I just remember thinking, oh no, like I think of female surfers as being so strong and not sexualized. But is that naive of me? Like, was there pressure to be sexualized?
There was a lot of pressure to be sexualized. There was a lot of objectification of women in the surfing world. And we literally parade around in a bikini our whole lives. So I've learned that the best thing you can do is actually just get okay with how you feel in yourself, because everyone like you is going to have an opinion and a perspective and an objective of what the ideal surfer body or surfer female or even female is going to look and feel and do. So I can't live up to everyone else's perspective of me, so I have to define my own. Once again, I mean, that's what my course is all about. It's helping people own their truth, identify who they are, what their strengths are, and ground themselves in that so they're no longer dictated by external circumstances. And that takes a lot of work. And I don't know many teenagers that can really say that I know exactly who I am and what I stand for, and I'm not going to be dictated to by the rest of the world, because we have this deep craving and sense of necessity to belong. And if we don't feel like we belong, we'll go to extreme circumstances to make sure we do. What's your relationship like with your body?
It's evolving, because I'm the same age as you, about to be 50 in a couple of years, and perimenopausal, and stuff changes. Like, I've got these big boobs that I don't know what to do with. And it makes going for a run really hard. And like, you notice yourself thickening around the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter how fit you are or how much exercise you do.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's about acceptance. And for me also, it's about acceptance of my face. Like, body image doesn't finish at the neck.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at you and you don't look like you've had Botox, and I feel so grateful.
Well, you can see all the lines on my forehead.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got sleep lines and frown lines.
Same. And I've got pillow lines and shit.
No, I won't get Botox because it's just a short-term solution. And it's a – I don't understand the need to paralyze my face. Like, you know, my husband still can't accept the fact that I'm embracing my age by not coloring my hair. I haven't colored my hair for years. So, you know, I'm embracing my grays and my blondes. And, yeah, the natural aspect of me is what I'm learning to embrace. One thing that you mentioned on being perimenopausal, I'm in the middle of menopause. I started when I was 42. So I've been going through it for 6 years now.
Oh, speak to me.
Oh, my goodness. It's brutal. And I'm not doing anything. I'm not taking any hormone replacement treatment, and I'm not taking anything natural. I'm actually just riding the waves, the sweats and the brain fog and the lack of libido and the memory loss. And like, I'm in the middle of a conversation or in the middle of a keynote presentation and a word just disappears. And I'm like, where is it? Like, it's up there somewhere.
I'm so glad you say that, because then you can also go, am I like, is it early onset dementia?
Yeah.
Like, I just can't remember. And then someone will say, remember this? And I'll go, I've got no recollection of having that conversation at all.
For me, that's exactly what I'm enduring.
And the night sweats. I think I had night sweats last
night. I've noticed also my sweats can be triggered by stress. So if I start thinking about something that upsets me, I'll have a sweat.
Like night sweats.
In the middle of the day, during the day, like, I sweat all day, every day. Like, I'll start thinking about a deadline, or I'll start thinking about, I remember I was at the doctor 2 days ago with my dad, and we started talking about guardianship and, you know, power of attorney, and I started having a sweat. And then I saw my dad take his jacket off. I'm like, oh, he's menopausal too. He's having a sweat.
It's true what you say about your body keeps changing, and it's almost like we live in this society that tells us our body must not change when we get older, if we are sick, if we're well, if we're pregnant, if we've had a baby. We've got to stay frozen literally at 23.
It's so unrealistic, isn't it? And social media has a lot to answer for. But it's our decision to buy into that and to buy into this illusion that that's actually real. We're subscribing to somebody else's illusion that that can actually happen for us. And that's how a lot of industries play on our vulnerabilities and make us believe that by utilizing this product or wearing this particular thing or doing this thing or driving this car is going to make you feel that much better about yourself. Like, it's propagating this belief that you're never going to be enough. No matter how hard you try, you're not going to be enough. But we're going to give you this glimmer of hope that if you do this, then it's going to make you feel enough, but only for a short period of time, and then you're going to have to keep doing more and more and more and more and more. It's just unsustainable, and it's unrealistic, and it's not right, is it? I mean.
No, it's a head fuck, quite simply.
It is a head fuck, 100%. Yeah. It's a vortex that just sucks you in, and you just get spat out and going, hang on, I'm no different to how I was when I went into this. So, wow, what a waste of time that was.
You must have felt very anxious having lost two of your mums to cancer when Kirk was diagnosed.
Yes, that was a really unsettling period.
How's he doing?
He's amazing. Yeah, he's so good. I don't like to use the cliche, because you know how a lot of people go through these traumatic, life-changing events and go, it was a blessing for me. I don't wish to use it as a cliche that it was a blessing, but it certainly made him prioritize his health and well-being and make him realize that he is responsible for the actions that he takes and the choices that he makes. And I'm really proud of him. You know, he's always taken good care of himself. I mean, he's 62 and he looks so good, and he's at the gym right now. And we do the 5-2 diet, so today's a fast day. And he embraces those things. You know, as much as he likes to just bitch about the fact he can't have a beer today, he still embraces the fact that he's chosen to have a fast day, because he knows yesterday he got smashed. He got hammered last night. And that was really funny. But that episode of Cancer with Kirk was really unsettling, because there's so much uncertainty wrapped around it. And the way in which he was diagnosed was really unacceptable. His oncologist emailed him and said, "You've got cancer. You've got prostate cancer. Enjoy your holiday. We'll see you in 2 weeks."
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
No indication of the severity, the location, other than that was prostate. I mean, we were heading the next day to New Zealand on a holiday, and he treated the holiday as like his last hurrah. Not as in he was going to die, but in the way in which he currently lived was no longer going to be feasible. So every day we drank a bottle of rosé and ate a massive bowl of hot chips. Like, that was his final request.
His bucket list.
Yeah, before he went on a keto diet, which he didn't have to do because the severity of the cancer enforced him to play the hand of going in for robotic surgery and keyhole surgery and having his prostate taken out, which is a whole nother journey for him to negotiate. But I remember coming back from our holiday and I had armed myself with a bunch of questions, because for the first 5 days he and I were both numb, and I was shocked and he was shocked, and we just didn't talk about it because we didn't know how to. And I said, "Kirk, we've got 5 days to arm ourselves with as much knowledge as we possibly can." So we went onto the internet and went down the rabbit hole of conflicting information and knowledge, and went, "Okay, this isn't going to help too much." So when we went to the oncologist with a whole bunch of questions, he just shut them down and said, "Listen, sorry, but you're just going to have to get surgery." And then we walked into Peter Stricker's office, who's the rock star of the prostate surgery world, who had this pinstripe suit with the coat of arms on his cufflinks. I'm like, "I like this guy. This guy knows what he's doing. He's full of confidence," except he kept calling Kirk Nick. So
that, at least you knew he wasn't starstruck.
That's true. That shattered my confidence a little bit. But
no special treatment for Nick Pengilly.
No. Whoever that is, I feel sorry for the bastard.
I just wanted to finish up by asking you about your relationship to surfing now.
Mm-hmm. My relationship to surfing is my happy place. The ocean and surfing is my place of freedom, my place of individualized expression. It's my place of solace. And I love to surf. I mean, I love to immerse myself in nature and I love to immerse myself in the ocean, but there's nothing quite the same as jumping on a surfboard and paddling out into the wild blue yonder, surrendering myself to a force that's way more powerful than me, and then paddling into a wave with no idea what's going to be on offer, but with this anticipation and excitement that it could be the best wave of my life, you know, and there's an opportunity to continue to grow and change and adapt and learn. And it's just such a fulfilling environment for me. So whenever I'm unhappy or whenever I want to celebrate, I go surfing, because that's where I find a new lease on life.
I was thinking that it's so different to so many other professional athletes, because if you're a runner or if you're a swimmer, you can't transition from competition to like, "I'm just going to go for a 100-meter sprint or do some casual hurdles on the weekend."
Yeah, or go and play cricket or tennis. Or,
yeah.
Yes, exactly.
So, but for you, it's something that's been able to stay woven into your life forever.
100%. It's gone from an occupation to a vocation, and I'm really grateful that I have surfing in my life, because without it, I'd probably go insane. But yes, I am more in love with surfing today than I've ever been in my life. And that's obviously got a lot to do with the fact that there's no pressure and expectation on me. I still place a little bit of pressure and expectation on my own shoulders to go out there and perform in a way that I expect myself to perform in my late 40s, keep up with these kids who have very little respect for their elders, stick it to the guys who still can't measure up, and be a bit of a law enforcement officer when people aren't respecting the natural etiquette of the ocean. So, you know, I've still established myself out in the lineup, and it's still great when people paddle up and get all excited to see me in the water. But all in all, it's a non-negotiable activity for me that I always schedule the time in for, and recognize that I don't surf to make me happy. I'm happy because I surf.
We're very lucky to have you, and that you've transitioned from your sporting career into this extraordinary beacon of light and education. And the Awake Academy just sounds absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you.
You know, I can often tell when I'm doing an interview with someone when I'm going close to an area that is going to make them maybe feel upset or feel emotional. But with Lane, I thought she was okay, and that grief just seemed to come out of nowhere, which is, I guess, what grief does. And afterwards, I said to her, I hope you're okay. I'm really sorry if that was upsetting for you. And she said, no, thanks for triggering me. I really mean that. Thanks for making me feel connected to my mum in that moment, which really tells you everything you need to know about the extraordinary Lane Beachley. She is also one of those people who made her isolation mean something. While the rest of us, maybe me, was watching TikTok, Lane launched an online course called the Awake Academy that teaches you to unlock your internal GPS. It's all about self-development, focusing on mental health and resilience. And to find out more, you just have to go to awakeacademy.com.au, or you can find the link in our show notes. This episode of No Filter was produced by Leah Porges. The executive producer of No Filter is Eliza Ratliff. I'm Mia Friedman, and I will see you on mamamia.com.au.
The presenting partner of this episode of No Filter was HubSpot.
Something that isn't talked about nearly enough is menopause in the workplace. The Dove Menopause Insight Research, in partnership with Menopause Friendly Australia, revealed that only 6% of workplaces have a menopause policy, and that women experiencing menopausal symptoms can feel a loss of self-esteem and confidence at work, and in some cases, are leaving the workforce earlier. Dove champions real women and believes that they should be able to bring their whole selves to everything they do. They've created a toolkit to help start those important conversations about menopause at work. It's got everything from discussion ideas to policy templates. So join Dove in making workplaces more inclusive and a place every woman feels empowered to be her whole, authentic self. Visit dove.com/menopause to learn more about how to better manage menopause in the workplace.